Welcome to Jughead's Basement, Episode 10. That's two hands with four fingers and opposable thumbs, with the Jazz Butcher.
Well, now I'm your Jazz Butcher, and you've heard my name.
Has the name you chose for yourself in the band, The Jazz Butcher, has it dictated the style you play? And have you felt this has restricted you in any way?
It never dictated the style we played, and it was never supposed to. Like so many things, I mean, that name predates a single gig or a single demo tape even. It was really conceived just as a laugh. And the only reason it stuck around was that one of the first songs I did was the Jazz Butcher theme. So that kind of went Jazz Butcher, Jazz Butcher. I did another one about having sex with dead people called Zombie Love. And when I put this little 3 or 4 song tape together, I didn't really want to put my own name on it because I didn't really want to be some creepy guy from the village who was having sex with dead people. That's when I stuck Jazz Butcher on it. Just remember that from pissing around with my mate about 3 months before, and my pal just went, the Jazz Butcher. And I went, oh, yeah. It's probably been as much of a nuisance. I mean, you know, when people go like, oh, are you a comedy band? And you have to spend like 3 weeks explaining that, no, you're not. The Jazz Butcher thing, it's probably been as much of a nuisance as that with retrospect. I mean, this is what you get for starting out not taking yourself seriously and then suddenly being thrust into the world of seriousness with, like, agents and videos and all this nonsense. You don't plan for that when you're, like, 21 and mucking about with your mates, you know? And so it kind of develops. Yeah, it has been a nuisance, because for 30 years now, John, I've been saying to people, we don't play jazz and we don't eat meat for 30 years.
Just heard from Pat Fish, frontman and predominant songwriter of The Jazz Butcher. In 1982, Pat Fish and his rotating cast of Conspirators and Sikorskis from Hell embarked on their musical journey together in and around the English areas of Oxford and Northampton. Their first full-length release, Bath of Bacon, appeared on Glass Records in March of 83. What you are listening to at this moment is a song called Hard, recorded in January of 86. This is the first song I ever heard and bought by The Jazz Butcher, found in my local 80s record store under the heading Import, on a format phenomenon known as the vinyl 12-inch single. This podcast will center in on their second full-length record, Scandal in Bohemia, also on Glass Records, released during the winter of 1984. Besides fragments of all the songs on the record, you will hear interviews of the four band members who performed on Scandal in Bohemia, Pat Fish, Max Eiter, Owen Jones, along with Bauhaus and Love and Rockets songwriter and bassist David J. In addition to the aforementioned, mingled within, you will hear two personal pieces based on Jazz Butcher songs not appearing on Scandal in Bohemia by my friends Brian Mtuzek and Scott Herms. The idea of including songs not on the featured record is departing from my usual structure, and I have allowed this because The Jazz Butcher, more than any other band I know, is recognized by fans, in most part, not by the records, which were hard to come by in the US, but by the sheer catchiness and melodic velocity of the singles themselves. And now I proudly present to you The Jazz Butcher's Scandal in Bohemia, and then some. Max Eiter, tell us about track one, Southern Marksmith.
Played it with a flat finger.
The name Southern Mark Smith is based on the singer and frontman for The Fall, Mark Smith. But I don't think most of my U.S. audience is very familiar with the effect of Mark Smith on music and culture in the U.K. Can you please shed a little bit of light on that?
Yeah, the sort of cultural monolith effect.
Yeah.
I mean, he's so one of a kind. And I guess probably in much of his utterances, completely incomprehensible to Americans. He is very, 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 very Manchester. And that is why the whole concept of the Southern Mark Smith is just rubbish. I mean, it's like saying, I don't know, a wet desert or something. In fact, a wet desert is more likely than the Southern Mark Smith. It's fair to say that, I mean, in the market that we were talking to in England, even in like 1983, everybody knew who he was. You know, he was a titan of regional punk and way, way beyond. After the record came out, I don't know if anyone's told you the story about the letter that we got.
No, do it.
A letter arrived and it was on just regular paper, which had been stamped with a Cheap Brother stamp, The Four, Prestwich, Manchester. And it began, Dear Jazz Butcher. And it was a handwritten letter and it was just signed, The Four. And the trouble with the fact that it was handwritten was that one of the words looked quite difficult to decipher, and it took some time before we realised what they'd said was, we're still working your record out. Because for a few dreadful minutes, we were all staring at this thinking it said, we're still working your revenge out. Because, you know, Marky Smith, not a man to be crossed. But, like, we did, after all that nonsense, they invited us to support them on a couple of gigs here and there, and they were nothing but good to us. I mean, Smith's got this terrible reputation for being difficult and cantankerous, especially with support groups, but he was nothing but kind and helpful to us. His wife did punch Owen in the face, but she was well within her rights, as it goes.
I'm totally wired. I'm totally wired.
Yeah, now there was a night in Hammersmith where we'd done a set and we'd come off, and there were two almost identical dressing room doors next to each other, and Owen had come off and he wasn't in a good mood. He had felt he hadn't played well, had shit sound. He steams across the hall to these dressing rooms and I can see him going to kick the door open, and just as he moves his foot to do it, I think, Christ, wrong door. He's just booted his way into the Falls dressing room at like 20 miles an hour, right? But the door flies open and nearly knocks Brixie Smith off her feet while she's doing her makeup. Lead guitarist and Marky Smith's wife. Right? And she's literally just knocked over by Hurricane Owen coming through the door. Before he's had time even to realise his mistake, this tiny girl from Chicago just looks up at him, reaches up about, you know, 12 inches above head height, and smacks him right in the eye. And everyone agrees she was well within her rights. So apart from one instance of like overt physical violence, which was well merited, they treated us with nothing but kindness.
I'm going to start off here. Here's something I didn't even think to ask, and then I always assumed, I don't know why, that your name was Max Eider, and then I started Googling, and Eider is duck.
Yes, and that is why. I mean, I am very fond of ducks. The kind of thrill of the duck pond mainly leaves people at the age of about 10, but it never deserted me.
Where were you born and raised?
The mythical version is that I was born in Bohemia, the son of an Austrian count. But in fact, I was born in southern suburban London, the son of a civil servant.
I was wondering if it was going to be hard to interview you guys. That's why I was sort of nervous too, because I didn't know whether to exist in the fictional world.
No, a lot of these stories were just Pat, you know, trying to say something different, or, you know, to amuse himself or us, when at a time when we were doing quite a lot of interviews. And so, you know, some of these stories stuck, and, you know, we would see them repeated in all seriousness. But Pat, you know, he was always good at spinning a yarn.
Max Eider with Pat Fish from 1982 through 1986, then left the band, rejoining about 9 years later. How did you meet, and how did this meeting end up recording together for the first time?
We met at university in Oxford, and Pat was in a different band, and I was in a band myself. But eventually we ended up in the same band. When we left university, Pat went off and wrote the songs that became the Bath Bacon And I went down to London and was sort of auditioning for bands and sort of not knowing what the fuck to do, really. But he ended up sort of asking me to play on some of those. I think the first time we met was in Merton College, JCR, and it was towards the end of an evening. And I don't think either of us were very sober, and that's pretty much how it's stayed ever since.
Real men.
Wouldn't happen in China.
Can I ask what wouldn't happen in China?
Well, I was thinking in terms of sort of general low-level early 80s British street thuggery. But actually, the more I hear about the way the Han Chinese treat their ethnic minorities over there, I'm not sure that it probably doesn't happen in China.
What made you pick up an instrument? And is that the same influences that propelled you into actually being in a band?
Like a lot of people, I joined a band just because I wanted to be in a band with my friends. You know, we formed a band before any of us could play any instruments. But one of my friend's brothers was a little bit older, and he already had a band, and so they had they had some stuff set up, and so it was all kind of there for us. And I'm not quite sure why I ended up playing the guitar, really, but I did. Very unpromisingly for quite a while.
I have to admit that, I mean, even seeing videos of you, you're a pretty damn great guitar player. Did you feel it came naturally to you, or did you really work?
I worked pretty hard on it, not then, but a bit later on. It was basically that I couldn't play the sort of things that I wanted to play. You know, I could play the sort of tedious blues licks that everyone plays. I realised I'd either got to develop a bit of technique or was just not going to go anywhere. In my teenage years, I listened to quite a lot of progressive rock. You know, people being good at their instruments was not an alien concept to me. And it was only when I was 17 or 18 that punk started happening, and everyone started becoming very embarrassed to be able to play their instrument. But the idea of actually being a good musician was always something that I quite liked. I wasn't frightened of developing some technique.
When I went to the secondary school at the age of 13, I found myself in a school where they were very keen that kids should learn a musical instrument. I was a little football hooligan, I didn't really want to know, and I resisted it. Then over a couple of years, I was exposed to various exotic things like Pink Floyd and stuff like that, kind of early 70s music. And suddenly I was desperate to play an instrument, and I wanted to play the piano. So I went to the teacher and I said, look, you know how you like your kids to play instruments? I'd love to learn the piano. And he says, you're 14, you're too old. I said, what? He said, there's muscles that you don't know exist that you use playing the piano, and you've lost them already. I ended up learning to play the flute. Put your finger up, put your finger down. I got to enjoy playing the flute, and I used to play along with these like 70s prog records. I used to play along with the guitar solos by ear on the flute. But I realised that as a little football hooligan turning into a music fan, that one thing that wouldn't suit a man of my size really would be to be a flute player. So I went to my music teacher and I said, what about the old tenor sax? I hear it's like the flute. He says to me, yeah, I'll teach you the tenor sax. Don't tell anyone, I'll get you home from the school. And so I learnt the tenor sax, and basically I started playing in bands as a sax player and a bit of a singer. But all the time, I just thought, well, I'm not a very good sax player. And by 1980, it's David Bowie's fault. All these people who couldn't play the saxophone were playing saxophones on records. Poor old fucking Duncan in the Psychedelic Furs. Great band, terrible sax player. They were everywhere in 1980, 1981. It was that year's didgeridoo, and they were just all these guys trying to play sax who couldn't. And it really brought home to me that I would never be a good sax player. So at that point, I thought, well, what's to be done? And I thought, well, for some reason, I've got a songwriting feeling, and I think I knew that I was leaving the band I was in. You know, I had to make a different way in the world. And so I thought, well, I've obviously got to learn to play the guitar, so I did. And that led to songwriting quite quickly, and almost accidentally led to making records. Real men from
hell. Soul Happy Hour.
This is the one where the cat plays the piano. There was a huge, handsome, big old black and white fat cat living at Woodbine Studios, and his name was Basil. On the intro there, it's, I want to go to the Tesco store, buy some drink, roll around on the floor, and you just hear a little piano go, bink, in the kind of Noel Coward style. It's our little nod to the master. But those notes on the piano are actually played by Basil. Under my direction, I will admit, but he's sitting in my lap at this grand piano, and I just take his paw and we just go. And we didn't cue-bass it or anything. He was spot on. Good old fat Basil. He came good on the piano on that one. So that's what I think of the Soul Happy Hour.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the SDP. I want to go to the Tesco store, buy some drink and fall on the floor.
Pat, where were you born and raised?
I was born in the outer edge of West London, and I stayed there until I was about 4 or 5 years old.
I don't care for smart new clothes. I don't care for reading books.
My father, who I really don't mind saying on the radio was an idiot, decided that the future of pretty much all business in the United Kingdom would be this town, Northampton, about 60-70 miles north of London, up the newly opened first freeway that we had in the country. It opened in about 1960, and it basically ran about 70 miles. Our motorway, the M1, ran from London about 70 miles, and it stopped at Northampton. And Northampton is, to be fair, pretty much the dead centre, epicentre geographically of England, but it never quite became the mecca that you thought it would. And at 5 years old, I found myself stranded in a village outside of Northampton in the severest winter Britain had had since 1948.
If you look at some of the musicians that came out of there, it was, you know, David Jay and you, just to begin with, or both the Haskins. I'm just trying to give the audience sort of a feel of what was going on at that time musically that would spark you guys to sort of create a new movement.
Well, we were, I mean, it was kind of fun in a way. I mean, I can remember, I was living in Oxford. I hadn't even moved to Northampton yet. I was still living in Oxford. There was a bar where we would go every Saturday night, and every Saturday night there'd be a band on for free. And like most of us were on the dole, so like anything free, yeah, that's where we were. And it was where all the punks would be and all the hippies and, you know, pretty much everyone together in this one bar. And I remember going there one night in December, maybe 79. A Saturday night, there's a guy on the door. It's 20p, mate. 20p? To go to the pub? Yeah, well, the band's from Northampton, mate. Bit of petrol money, mate. Yeah, okay, 20p, Northampton. You know, I'm there. And I go in, and this is like Bauhaus's eighth gig or something. And I don't know them. I haven't been in Northampton for years. I've been living in Oxford for about 4 or 6 years. And there are these guys from Northampton, and I really don't know them. You know, they were part of a wave that was starting to fill up the John Peel programme. You're hearing it a lot. It's kind of very stark, kind of post-punk, very serious. And I mean, right from the word go, they were different because they were very inventive. You know, when they were playing in pubs, they still had a girl with a flashlight down the front so that you could have a little spotlight on Murphy's face, even though it was in a pub. They were clever from the word go, that lot. But, you know, there was so much of this. They came along and the Banshees came along. And then, of course, you get the second and third waves, like, you know, fucking Norwich's answer to Bauhaus or Exeter's answer to Susie and the Banshees. And, of course, it becomes more diluted and more ham-fisted and more depressingly useless. And by the time it got to like 1982 on the British music scene, all you were really hearing down the radio was like the mainstream stuff, like, you know, all the chart nonsense. If you turned on anything remotely alternative and there were only like one or two shows, then you'd be getting endless grinding post-goth nonsense bands like Bone Orchard.
Mother, I'm an alcoholic.
Bands that even the most hardest core goth could not respectably show their face at. The influence of Bauhaus hung very heavier for Northampton in the years after their success. And like, I could, you know, when I first met them, it was like, bloody hell, pop stars. I've actually been chased down the street by schoolgirls because I was with David Jay. You know, and their influence hung heavy, and there were a lot of very poor Bauhaus imitators clogging up the pubs of Northampton at the time. With the Jazz Butcher shit and that, me and Ida, we were almost reacting against that. You know, that had been around for a year or two, and we were hearing too much of it, and we were like, oh, fuck this shit, man. 1950s, 1960s, Stax, Velvet Underground. We were feeling like that, so we were almost reacting against all that, and we were certainly reacting against comedy synth music like Blancmange. At the same time that we wanted to like be really pure about it, we too were infected because we'd seen guys, because it was the early 80s, so we'd seen sort of cool guys in zoot suits and shit, and thought, ooh. So it wasn't that we were unpolluted, but we thought we were reacting against sort of serious, not playing very well goth music.
David J on Northampton.
Very flat and boring and a bit of a cultural wasteland, really. It's just, there wasn't much going on at all, and we had to entertain ourselves.
What was the first instrument you learned to play?
Six-string guitar.
What influenced you to pick up this instrument, and was this the same influences that propelled you into taking the steps to write and perform with the band?
The initial thing was hearing T-Rex on the radio, and that had a huge impact on me. And then David Bowie, almost simultaneously. And my friends were all drawn to the same star, and then there were about five of us, and we all wanted to be the lead guitar player, or at least the rhythm guitar player. Nobody wanted to be the bass player. But I volunteered to be the bass player because I was also into reggae.
Give it to me one time.
But reggae was really the first music that I ever really got into, and I would go out and buy records. My friends and I used to sneak into this skinhead discotheque where we were tolerated by the skins, and we would hear this music played really loud. Although I didn't really understand which instruments made which sounds, I was very much attracted to the bottom end of those records, and then, you know, I realised, oh, that's got something to do with the bass guitar. So when nobody wanted to be the bass player, I as I say, volunteered, and my first bass was a very cheap, horrible red electric guitar, and I took the two top strings off, stuck it into an amp, rolled all the top end off, rolled all the bass up, and that's how it started.
I need meat.
When I listened to this album, which I hadn't done for a very long time, that was one of the tracks that I'd forgotten about, and I rather enjoyed it. I don't think we'd ever done anything like that before, that kind of sort of vaguely rockabilly stuff, and I don't think we ever did again, but it sounds quite good to me.
What that really makes me think of is my own stupidity, because it seemed fun. I mean, at that point, I still did eat meat, and it seemed kind of funny with Jazz Butcher and meat and basically what's it saying? It's saying, I want to have sex with you. It was kind of naive and kind of stupid. But on the upside, Dave J gets to do that thing with his bass.
I've been riding on a runaway bus, can't control the two of us.
David, how did you come to be acquainted with Pat and Max?
I heard the name the Jazz Butcher being bandied around town, and he had a reputation as being something of an eccentric, but a talented eccentric, so I was quite intrigued by this. And I would also see Rollo around town.
Rollo McGinty played in Jazz Butcher, and he also played in the band The Wooden Tops.
And I got too confused, and I thought Rollo was the Jazz Butcher initially. And then one day, you know, Pat put me right on that. First time I saw him play in a pub with Max Ider, and they were doing the duo thing, and I was enormously impressed. I was very enamoured of their witty and charming banter, and the way they had this sort of nonchalance, and it was very appealing. And then, of course, Pat's songs and gems, you know. So I felt this big attraction, and I wanted to be involved on some level, so I thought maybe I could produce him.
Max Ider said that you could basically talk your way into anything you wanted to be involved in. Between the initial disbanding of Bauhaus and the formation of Love and Rockets, not to mention your continuing solo career, you somehow managed to weasel your way into Jazz Butcher. What lured you into such a decision, and what did the band actually fulfill for you?
I wanted to come on board as a producer. The idea of taking these songs and colouring them. They were full of wit, and musically they're very melodic. The melodies were always appropriate to the sentiment of the lyric, and I just thought it was just very engaging, and I loved the idea of going into studio with them and fleshing out these songs, which I heard, you know, in a very stripped down form, and just making them really come to life. So it's just a piece. I had my producer's hat on, which I hadn't really worn that much. I had only sort of been a co-producer with the band and with my own stuff. And it was really the first time that I ventured out into the role of being a producer for another artist.
Where in there did it lead to actually you playing the bass?
I ended up playing on a couple of tracks, and then they weren't sure about their current bass player, and they seemed to favour me, so I played on more tracks, and they seemed pretty obvious that I was slowly stepping into another role, that of bass player in the Jazz Butcher Group, which I was very happy to be in that position. And then we started to do a gig together, and that was terrific fun. So all of a sudden, I was, you know, the official bass player, and that was it. You know, so I didn't join with the intention of being the bass player; it just naturally evolved out of my being the producer.
You very kindly called it an influential album. It was certainly an album made under the influence, as David pointed out.
How about Owen Jones? I don't know anything about Owen.
Owen is a Welshman, very passionate, very handsome, very tough, very well-travelled, a proper socialist, and he's a follower of Joe Strummer. That pretty much explains Owen in many ways. I mean, he's Welsh, he's deep, he's dark, there's plenty in there. From a superficial point of view.
What's he doing in Germany?
Having a great time.
Okay.
The first gigs we ever did in Germany were in Hamburg, and the first night we were there we met a very nice couple called Tommy and Bärbel, and it was really Tommy's doing that we even got a gig in Germany. He worked for an agency, and the story goes that
David Barker was the owner of Glass Records, a British independent record label which operated from 1981 to 1989.
Sent them a copy of Scandal in Bohemia over to their office in Hamburg to see if maybe we could get a gig there. Which, frankly, was like, to me, science fiction. Play in a foreign country? You must be joking, you know? Anyway, the story goes, Dave sent in this thing, and one morning the phone rang in Dave's office, and here was Tommy on the phone saying, "Yeah, I want to book the Jazz Butcher." So, fantastic, became a great friend. We got really well in with Hamburg. The first two gigs went really well. And pretty much from the word go, it was clear that there was a thing happening between Tommy's girlfriend and Owen, that there was a chemistry there that was not to be denied. And it took a year or maybe 18 months. We were always over in Germany playing, and they saw more and more of each other, and eventually they proper fell in love. Tommy took off quite honourably, really, and they moved in together in about 1985. And the way that Owen always says it, he actually has a song which he introduces with these words, so I'm not breaking any confidences. He said this in public, but he says that when people ask him why did he move to Hamburg, he said it was down to two women. One of them is Bärbel, because I fell in love with her. And the other one was Margaret fucking Thatcher, because I wanted to be as far out of her country as I could possibly manage.
Owen Jones, where were you born and raised?
I was born in London and raised there as well, although I've always regarded myself as Welsh. My whole family roots are in Wales. And my dad moved down to London just before I was born, in fact, for a job. And that's why I was raised in southwest London, yeah. My nationalism is limited to the sports field, really.
Oh, and you played drums in the Jazz Butcher. What was your first instrument?
The first instrument I learned was piano. When I was in school, I played the timpani in the orchestra. I played percussion and classical music. When Max and I met up, well, we'd known each other for a few years, but when we became good friends, which was at college, he wanted to form a band and he wanted a drummer. And because I'd been a percussionist, that was the obvious thing for me to take over. So, in fact, in some ways, Max basically taught me to play the drums originally. He showed me the basics. And that's how I ended up on the drums. Having said that, I rarely play the drums anymore. I play mainly guitar and accordion and that.
What's the name of your current band?
My band now is called Shakespeare and the Bible.
And now, here's my friend Brian Nemtuzak sharing his story based on the September 1985 release of The Human Jungle, Side B, The Devil Is My Friend.
Most glosses on Pat Fish inevitably invoke the phrase British eccentric, code for a highly codified brand of iconoclasm with a venerable lineage. Roughly, a wizard crossed with a mad scientist slash poet, crossed with a dandy slash jester, crossed with a creepy slash cool uncle, crossed with a music hall troubadour, crossed with a free-thinking professor slash detective. Throw Merlin, Newton, Hume, Swift, Blake, Lewis Carroll, Wilde, Gilbert and Sullivan, Bertrand Russell, and Sherlock Holmes into a blender, and you just about have it. The British eccentric stands apart, but in a very specific way, which ultimately, of course, amounts to Doctor Who, which ultimately amounts to the sci-fi version of the British rock star in America. Think about it. The Doctor hit the airwaves in 1963, just in time for the British invasion. And while at first glance they're not the most intuitive of bedfellows, the shared characteristics of the Time Lord and the British rock star are actually legion. Familiar yet alien, check. Smart but unconventional, check. Dashing but outlandish, check. Faintly sexually ambiguous. More than faintly piratical. Problematically arrested adolescent, check. Mildly loony mentor slash corrupter, shaman slash huckster slash charismatic cult leader, check. What's that got to do with British eccentric Pat Fish, a.k.a. the Jazz Butcher? Well, the funny thing about the Jazz Butcher conspiracy, ETC, is that almost nobody seems to know much about it. People otherwise steeped in rock and pop history, even of the time, will recognize the name, but confess that's all they know. Most Bauhaus and Love and Rockets fans have no idea bassist David J played in the band, if they've heard of it at all. Somehow, the Jazz Butcher really, really falls through the cracks, which made stumbling on it in pre-internet mid-80s McHenry IL, then a not-quite-suburban redneck burg of 13,000, rather unlikely. But stumble I did in high school, thanks to this nerd rock star whose legend reverberated through its halls. A kind of real-life Val Kilmer from Real Genius. A state debate champion and reported jazz band road trip provocateur who had knitted his own version of famous Teeth and Curls' Fourth Doctor Tom Baker's 50-foot scarf. Listened to the English Beat and the Jam and R.E.M. and Elvis Costello. Not that remarkable, but believe me, remarkable for mid-80s McHenry. And had graduated as valedictorian before going off to the USC to study astrophysics before switching to AI. Or I should say, thanks to secondhand descriptor, surrogate older brother, and upperclassman Dylan O'Leary. He had studied under this guy, who had graduated the year before I started, and still saw him when he had come home, and lived on the magical second floor of his parents' house that had once been a recording studio that his parents never, ever came up into. Dylan didn't just teach me about the Val Kilmer guy's moves, but the transformative power of trench coats, sunglasses, and extracurricular theater. Hilarious old man affectations like drinking gin and tonics while playing cribbage and smoking cigars on his enclosed porch. And the lifeline esoteric music and movies, in the analog age, used to uniquely extend beyond some soul-sucking mid-American milieus. To some extent, they were both Doctor Who to me, their lack of Britishness trumped by their swaggering international eccentricity. In case you hadn't guessed, I was a hardcore of solitary fan at the time, staying up late past Monty Python every Sunday night. One, a tangible model for surviving, the other a symbol of escaping, crushing small-town gravitation. So one day when Dylan dropped that the Kilmer dude had renounced all previous musical favorites for this Jazz Butcher quantity, it was a big deal, even if it sounded to be jazz-related. Which, of course, it wasn't. And the first track he played for me was The Devil Is My Friend.
The devil is my friend, the devil is my friend. Wherever I go, the devil is my friend. What'd you think about that, boy?
Something like half of the Jazz Butcher's catalog is about alcohol abuse. But The Devil Is My Friend is actually a drinking song that sketches out a super brief, sort of, cautionary tale involving alcohol abuse, then swiftly devolves into a rousing name check of iconoclasts, from Godzilla to Frank Sinatra to Love and Rockets. The juxtapositions describe a bumpy pantheon of antiheroes, from fetishized to banally evil to jokingly villainous, all prescribed a particularly 80s jauntiness. Which seems partly silly, free associative fun, and partly a reflection of the way British eccentricity, starting with psychedelia, Barrett and Bolan and Bowie, had spread throughout British rock stardom by that point. To one side of the Jazz Butcher is quintessential British eccentric Robin Hitchcock. To the other is Captain Sensible. To another is Andy Partridge, and so on and so on. Almost like coexisting incarnations of a certain Gallifreyan vagabond.
Hey, hey, the clowns are white.
But there was never an eccentric, looser or archer than Pat Fish. Cocktail party bounder and literate wastrel par excellence. In fact, if you were to hop into a TARDIS say, with Fey Fifth Doctor Peter Davison, whose cool 80s affect also wasn't far off, and round up all the British eccentrics throughout time, from Merlin to Wilde to Dylan O'Leary, and even Lennon to Davies to Donovan, for a big-ass British eccentric blowout. You get the feeling the house band would have to be the Jazz Butcher. Backed by David Tennant and David J. And Godzilla.
The devil is my friend. The devil is my friend. Wherever I go, the devil goes. The devil is my friend.
As records progress and bands start having less time in between recording full lengths to work on songs, were those songs pretty well worked out before you went into the studio?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, we both had these dual cassettes. Machines that you could bounce, you know, you could bounce from one cassette to the other. You know, that's how we used to do our multi-track demos in those days. We'd exchange tapes, and then eventually we would get together at his place or at mine. I seem to remember that by the time we got into the studio, we had a pretty good idea. That might be completely wrong. That's what I seem to remember.
You're like the me of my band. I'm the one that I can't. It's all, the memories are all jumbled up.
Absolutely. I really am bad. And I have to ask, you know, Pat's amazing. He can remember the hotel. He can remember where we went to dinner. You know, all I can remember people. I can remember the people we met.
Yeah, you're exactly like me too. I could remember, I can always remember a face, but I can't remember the name of a venue or what year it was.
So I always have to ask him, where was I? What the fuck were we doing there?
Just like Betty Page.
Yeah, we still play it. We still play it out. I mean, we played it in New York about 6 weeks ago. It's all about the Ida, isn't it, really?
I played that on an acoustic guitar, and it was extremely difficult to do. I should have played it on the electric, although it wouldn't have sounded the same. But I got into the studio and decided, I know what, I'll play it just like Django Bloody Reinhardt on an acoustic guitar. And then like 20 takes later, I'm thinking, not sure this was quite such a good idea.
Hey, 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 can I see you again? It's been such fun, what we've done. I should like to do it forever, hey. Tell me what do you
I say? Talked to Max and Pat about their relationship. Those two have probably worked together more consistently than anyone else in the band.
They were the core of the band. Obviously, you know, I mean, it's Pat's songs, and Max's absolutely inimitable guitar style that makes that sound more than anything else.
Two very different people, too, as we were saying there. Pat remembers everything, and Max can't remember anything and doesn't know dates or places.
They are two very different people, but, I mean, that's when it works best quite often. Look at Lou Reed and John Cale, for example. And it's a bit of a cliche to call it creative friction, but they're coming at things from two different angles, and I think that can be very positive. And, you know, they're still at it.
Scandal in Bohemia was the first full-length recording in the studio with a full band. Max, was there much anticipation and anxiety going in?
It's the first time we'd ever done, you know, a decent recording studio, and it was all, you know, it was all done in 2 weeks, so it's quite intense, but... You know, with the previous one, we'd been just staying at people's houses or whatever, or staying at our own houses, and just. But here, you know, we were staying in a guest house, and you know, it almost felt like a proper band. So yeah, it was kind of exciting. I don't think we were frightened of anything in those days, because we didn't, you know, we had no sort of real aspirations to be anything in particular. You know, we were just having a laugh, so it was all good, really.
Actually, you raised a good point about Scandal there. I think Pat was trying to get back to pop music. He used to be very specific in interviews that we play pop music and not rock music, because rock had this tone of over-seriousness about it. What we're playing here is entertainment. I mean, he writes some very intelligent lyrics and everything, but it's for popular entertainment is what he's trying to do. You know, it's like I say, even at its lowest, most ideologically sound levels, the pop music game is like unavoidably commercial, isn't it? And I have a sort of English middle-class horror of the commercial and the vulgar, and I just shrink from that shit, which, it's fine on the Corinthian field of play, but I'm getting a bit old for that kind of thing. It's an attitude that doesn't help you as a pop singer, you know. It's like you're supposed to be able to push yourself and smile at people, but I find that kind of difficult.
yeah, we both of us have a bit of a horror of things that are, you know, self-consciously clever. I suppose we both stray into that area every now and again. Yeah, it's a fine line, isn't it, between being amusing and just being a smartass.
Now to question 5.95. Starts out with a quote. I was told, incidentally, that if we released this on glass, we could expect a top global sale of 2,000. We released it on glass and sold about 25,000 copies. What were your expectations?
Well, to be honest with you, Theo Chalmers, Jerry Red, was the fellow who said, oh, yeah, if you stick with Dave, you'll sell 2,000. My reaction would have been, mate, if I sell 2,000, I'll be delighted. Arthur Bacon had sold about 750 at that point. So I really wasn't that concerned. I can't even remember why we were there. I think Dave had taken us down to Cherry Red, maybe with a view to getting me a few quid's worth of publishing or something. But it was a very strange afternoon. All these Cherry Red people were kind of trying to poach me, and it was really like, why? I'm nobody. Fuck off. I should have been flattered, but for some weird reason, I responded in completely the other way. I felt kind of faintly revolted, you know. As for selling 25,000 copies of Scandal in Bohemia, well, you can probably guess, I was delighted. I mean, these were sales beyond my wildest dreams. When we made Bartha Bacon, someone said to me, what do you want out of it? And I said, well, if it sells enough records that they let me make another one, and I can spend my fortnight's holiday next summer doing that, fantastic. So that's all I really ever wanted out of Bath. Scandal, I mean, it's kind of weird making Scandal because it was a completely different order of studio, and John Rivers was so educational. He told us so many things that we simply didn't know.
Can you give me a for instance?
Oh, absolutely. I'll give you a straight up for instance. Oi, Owen, what? Why don't you play the kick drum at the same time as David's playing the bass? We're on our second LP. No one's told us, right? Just little things like that. And also, of course, having John and David there really, really... I mean, Max and Owen and I, we were babes in the wood. You know, we hadn't got a clue. We were just playing for a laugh. And I suppose, really, in the making of Scandal, there was a kind of feeling that we were making a different kind of record. I can certainly remember a couple of occasions where I probably made a royal pain of myself by kind of getting the hump about it and thinking, oh, this has gone all professional and like a real record. And I wanted to be like a little bit weird, like Eno, and sort of stomping off to the pub in a huff for an hour and a half, you know, and then coming back and hearing it and thinking, oh, that's pretty fucking brilliant, actually.
Marnie.
All I can see is a picture of Pat in that stupid bloody sailor's hat. That's what that song means to me.
Marnie, Ider said he can only think of your sailor hat.
The sailor hat photographs. It was like a Tuesday morning. For whatever reason, I'd got an appalling hangover. And basically, I decided, fuck it, I'm not going to work. And I was lying in bed at like 11:30 in the morning. I should have been at work for 2.5 hours, but I was just lying in bed feeling sorry for myself. I honestly can't remember why, but I was. Phone? No, we had no phone. The phone didn't ring. The door went boom, boom, boom. And my flatmate, Mitch, who of course is the photographer, is standing over me in my bed going, come on. I'm going, what do you want? And he goes, we're doing the photographs for your single. I'm going, what, now? He goes, yeah. And I think, well, I'll dress in a way that once I've done this, I can go into work for the afternoon, you know, and not be in complete disgrace. Seeing as I'm getting up, I might as well go to work in the afternoon. So I've got like a suit and a jumper on, halfway respectable. Mitch marches me into Abington Park, sticks me in these bushes, and says, put your sailor hat on. Honestly, John, I'm half awake in them photographs. I've been out of bed for about 40 minutes. I've had no coffee, no tea, no food. I'm just out of bed. All they've done is put clothes on me and stick me in a bush. Pat knew exactly what he wanted, you know, writing songs myself. I know this too, that you have it in your head. Sometimes it's difficult if the band says, you know, we really think this bit should go like this instead of how you presented it. And I've gradually learned to listen to my band now, or I've gradually learned to trust them, and sometimes to let things go. I mean, your instinctive reaction is, no, it's my baby, you do what I say. But if you're not going to be open to other people's
ideas in a band, then you might as well do it all at home on a computer, because that's possible these days. On that general theme, I have to say, I mean, all of our relationships with Pat was stormy at various stages, but I understand the way he was thinking and the kind of pressure he was under a lot more now in retrospect, having spent the last few years in, you know, the same kind of role as just being the guy at the front who has to sort of face up to it all in the end.
You know, it seems to happen so much, so often. I mean, it's partly because, obviously, you know, there are egos involved. But I think it's also partly because, and this is something, again, I didn't really realise at the time, that the person that fronts the band is actually under a lot more pressure than the other people. I think it's just far more stressful, and if it's basically your band, you know, everyone wants to speak to you. You know, you have to do most of the interviews, and you're also thinking, oh Christ, I've got to write the next album or whatever. And so, I mean, I think there is a lot more pressure. I think that's one of the reasons why those people tend to go more nuts than others, and why the bass player just sort of sits there looking bemused.
Money's going to get in trouble. She's going to end up in a mess. Yes, yes.
For long periods, I would disappear. I'd be taken away by some bird in a car and driven around radio stations to answer asinine questions about who the fuck we were. The band wouldn't see me until, like, into the sound check. And I think Max especially got the feeling like, what's he doing pissing off in his open-top cars with these girls and carrying on and being on the radio and the rest of it? Yeah, he didn't even turn up to sound check. Can't. And I can totally understand that way of thinking. What he failed to realise was that I was having an utterly miserable time answering the same asinine questions day after day after day, accompanied by kind of thick-skinned major record company representatives who, you know, tomorrow it would be Motorhead and Girls' School, and the day after that it would be the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and the day after that it would be Katie Melua. You know, it didn't matter. Their kind of plastic enthusiasm could take all the passion out of your day in the course of an hour between 4 and 5 in an afternoon. And, you know, I would arrive at the sound check, like, almost weeping with joy to see my band and an instrument and an amplifier through which to make noise. They'd all be kind of, like, viewing me slitty-eyed with suspicion, as though I'd been, like, sneaking off to be Mick Jagger or something. It was only after he started making his own records, after a couple of years of that, and we were chatting again, Max said to me, you know, I totally misjudged you on that tour, because I just didn't realise to what extent selling the records demands that kind of nonsense and how much time and attention you have to spend on it. So I felt kind of vindicated by that. I did not enjoy the promotional experience, so I wasn't doing it for my ego.
And now what appears to be a sidetrack, a conversation with David J, which does come back around to the Jazz Butcher.
Bauhaus created the Gothic movement, which often takes itself dreadfully seriously. Having listened to that music, I had always figured that there was more to your band than this impression let on. That there was a dark sense of humor and a passion for Dada, surrealist Kurt Weill, trickery and buffoonery and wit. So it made sense to me that you would, for a while, take part in a band that, for all intents and purposes, is geared to opposite of the dark glamour of Bauhaus. Did you feel at all misunderstood by your audience or trapped in any way?
Yeah, sure, because we never took the Gothic thing seriously. I mean, we took elements of our music very seriously, but not you know, that Gothic mantle, you know. And sometimes we used to take the piss out of it, but we used to do it in a very subtle way, and sometimes that wasn't understood. And when we were being tongue-in-cheek, it was misconceived to be, in earnest. Quite often was not. Yeah, and it was refreshing to go into a room that was painted a very different colour. Come out of that all black room into a room that had splashes of colour. Mind you, there were some dark little cubby holes in that room occupied by the Jazz Butcher. There's a real darkness a lot of that music, and therein lies a lot of its potency. Pat has that certainly has a dark side.
Do you think the humorous, playful nature of your writing ever made it difficult to be taken seriously as a band or songwriter?
Oh, just a little bit, yeah. Yeah, I mean, one thing one gets in the United States, much more than one would like, is the Monty Python of rock. And at this point, you know, once you've heard that a few times, you just know that it's time to edge away and maybe see if you've got any more of those free beer tickets in your pocket, you know. Just because you have a sense of humour, I don't think that that makes you a comedy group. I mean, as you've pointed out, there was some quite sly humour in Bauhaus.
I was actually surprised how serious you guys did sort of seem live, at least from the footages I saw.
Yeah, I mean, we're not the Bonzo Dog Band, that's for certain. Apart from anything else, perhaps Max aside, but certainly me and Owen and David, although the music is quite simple, we were playing it to the best of our capacities, and, you know, that requires concentration. You can't be sort of clowning around while you're doing that. The comedic thing was when Bauhaus actually broke up in about 83. I knew David and Kevin by then. We'd supported him, in fact, on some occasion. And what was comical was that, you know, I said we were reacting to all that grim, let's all wear black and write songs in 6/8. Yeah, what was comical about the whole situation was that Kevin and Dave kind of joined our camp. You know, half of Bauhaus joined the anti-Bauhaus reaction.
Caroline Wheeler's birthday presents.
There are certain lines that stick in my head. In fact, I find myself quite often saying,
"Sheesh, oh, Caroline, what the hell was that?"
One thing it probably is worth saying, I mean, there's a lot of very literal stuff going on here. I mean, for example, Caroline Wheeler's birthday present. That is a song about Caroline Wheeler's birthday present. And Caroline Wheeler's birthday present was extremely big. There's no sort of real significance to that, apart from the fact that Caroline Wheeler had a big birthday present.
Yeah, no, this just occurred to me, actually. The sonic link is the track Caroline Wheeler's Birthday Present. And that sound of that really heavily distorted fuzz on the bass, which is the same fuzz box that they used in Bauhaus, that is what you hear on that. And it's that big monster riff. And that's how that started. We were just in the studio, and I started playing that thing, and Pat was like grinning from ear to ear, and he loved it, and he started writing those lyrics. But think about it, that is the link of that track.
I would never say it's one of my favorite, but it's the one that sort of sticks out in your brain from that record, because everyone is on it. I mean, there's voices from everyone on it, so it sort of gives you that feel of an ensemble working on a song.
It's a prime example of Pat's brilliant stream of consciousness, you know, and he more or less just wrote that in a flow and improvised around it when he was doing the vocal. It was very quick, and it gives an insight into that unique mind of his.
One thing the band very rarely did was rehearse. At that point, we'd never go to rehearsal studios or anything like that. We'd meet up. Max and I would drive up to Northampton. We'd meet up at Pat's and go through things acoustically. But we virtually never rehearsed, partly because pretty soon we were playing live so often it was hardly necessary. Some new songs here. I mean, Pat was, he knew how the song was going to be structured from scratch, really. He had it all in his head, definitely. The thing that was spontaneous in the studio was things like David's mad ideas, or my percussion on Playgroup, or the noises on Caroline Wheeler, for example, where Pat did the vocal, and we had a sort of fixed backing vocal with this na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. But we then, all four of us, also not entirely sober, had one go in the studio with a mic with a backing track up really loud, just shouting whatever came into our heads spontaneously.
I always love mistakes making it on there, and there's someone that's doing the na 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 na, you know, the background vocals, and does it one too many times.
Oh yeah, one that goes on. Yeah, that's Max. I definitely remember that being Max. It wouldn't be anyone else because he's got a mind like a sieve. I could tell you stories about Maximilian and missed aeroplanes and all kinds of things. Yeah, I do remember that. But yeah, I quite agree with you. It was definitely better to leave it there than not. It makes it real, doesn't it? What
passes for the mind of that song has already skittered away like an enraged spider, and it's going on about something else already. The original demo for that song was almost like an act of violence against music and life in general. But what it didn't have, being made in my living room, was actual musical violence, which the finished version, thanks to Dave, largely did. Yeah, it's just, imagine some horrid monster that's just chuntering to itself in a rage and moving really quickly across the mental landscape. You know, people have spent 30 years saying to me, gee, what's Caroline Wheeler's birthday present? And I think we just got the answer. It's a monster.
And now here's my friend Scott Herms, ruminating on a song from the Jazz Butcher's first record, Bath of Bacon. The song is Party Time.
This is party time, and we're all having so much fun. This is party time. I can look at all the girls that are in the room. This is party time. I can think of what I'll do when I get them home. This is party time. I think I'll have another of those. You always act so foolish. You always talk so dumb, but this is party time. And you got to say it's better than a war. This is party time. And it's better than a cold bath with someone you dislike. This is party time.
Favorite song.
They're playing our song.
Oh, I can't believe they're using my favorite song to sell cars. We all do it, but why? Why doesn't every song we hear make us go, fuck that? Here's how I feel about anarchy in the UK. Anarchy in the UK. It's not happening, no way. And if it did, a lot of people would die. So just relax and eat your shepherd's pie. Okay, so maybe lack of talent and being tone deaf has something to do with it. Or maybe it's a sign of our humanity. That we want to connect with other people, that we want to believe that we are not alone in the world, that other people have the same doubts, the same fears, the same joys, the same loves as we do. And then, when we hear it in a song, that combination of voices and instruments, the beat, our mother's comforting heart drum, that is when we go, yes, yes, I knew it. I knew I was not alone, and that someone understood what it was like to be me, but not too many people. Oh, no, 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 no. If too many people feel the way that I do, if too many people like the music that I do, that diminishes the feeling that I'm special. Yes, I don't want to be alone, but I do want to be special. A small group, the privileged few, that can feel in a refined way the way I do. But maybe I'm overthinking. Okay, I am overthinking. In the end, music surpasses reason, shoots straight through your ears, ducks under the brain, and lodges right in your heart. Sure, there's an intellectual enjoyment and appreciation of the absurd or the conflict between the lyrics and the music, as in Party Time, but in the beginning is the hook, and without the hook there is no song, and you cannot dissect the hook any more than you can break down love. Because that is what happens with a band or a song. You fall in love with them. You can come up with reasons why you love a certain band or a song. You can talk about their capabilities as musicians or their dynamic stage presence or about their politics. But in the end, that is all window dressing. I could go on and on about the reasons why I love Party Time, about how its faux cool jazz sound that it both embraces and mocks was a perfect antidote to every other kind of music being played on the radio in the 1980s, about how the song both eviscerates the partygoer and the mocker of partygoers, how the singer hates the fact that even as much as he hates parties, he has to go to them, because really, where else can you drink for free and at least have a chance to get laid, or, more importantly, at least be able to imagine that you have a chance to get laid? And yet at the same time, he takes himself to task for even bothering to make such a fuss about it. I mean, for Christ's sakes, it is just party time. And as horrible as it is not the worst thing in the world. And unlike a cold bath with someone you dislike, you may actually end up enjoying yourself. And I could tell you how every single aspect of this song matched my life at the time. How I was an overly clever, deeply miserable, heavily drinking, antisocial contrarian, always wanting to get laid, who desperately craved attention so everyone could appreciate how clever I was and feel sorry for my misery. And so every weekend I would get drunk, go to parties, and try to convince myself, and then some young woman, that I was worthy of her attention. But all of that is Colin Powell at the UN with yellow cake and aluminum tubes. I fell in love with the song first, and I invented the reasons later. I love this song because I love this song. And no amount of discussion or rationalization will make you feel this way unless you, too, love this song. In either case, I'm wasting my breath and your time because no one ever, ever fell in love with a song after being told they should. You don't enter into a contract with a band in exchange for $242 and 197 hours. I will receive unlimited smug satisfaction and a t-shirt to be named later. You fall in love with them. That is why we have guilty pleasure bands. Hey, I love Toxic by Britney Spears, and I sing along every time I hear it. It may not be the best song in the world, but it moves something within me. So keep loving the songs you love in spite of all reason. It's not the best situation, but it's better than a cold bath with someone you dislike. And this was party time.
And it's not polite for you to muck around. This is party time. And you know you'll only end up in disgrace. Ah, this is party time. And you know you won't be spending it here again. This is party time. Ah, it's a wonderful way to lose friends. You always act so stupid. You always talk so dumb. But this is party time.
Mind Like a Playgroup.
There's a great missing verse for that, or rather a missing chorus, which, I don't know, it disappeared in between the demo and the finished version. it did go like that, yeah. So there's this great lost chorus to Mind Like a Playgroup that used to go, "We don't care, Grandma in your armchair. We don't care, we don't care at all. We don't care... We will sell your armchair." And somehow or other, that never made it onto the record. And I'm damned if I know why. I loved it. how more uncaring can you get than to sell your grandmother's armchair from out underneath her, you know? It's a similar spirit to a few of the songs I've done, which is just like, no, I'm not playing, don't like modern life, not taking part. And that's pretty much the vibration. Of course, when we ended up doing it in encores in Germany on tour, it took a whole new dimension when Owen started punctuating it, not with tambourine or shaker, but by whacking members of the audience on the head with a tin beer tray. John, they were queuing up. You'd have these gigs in the 80s in Germany, and there'd be all these crazy, tough drunk lads down the front queuing up for Owen to whack him on the head to the sounds of Mind Like a Playgroup.
I have a mind like a playgroup with kiddies on the carpet, toys on the table, and lots of noise. People leave their thoughts here like they'd leave their kids there while they go out drinking and chasing boys. I don't care, even if they do stare. I don't care, I don't mind at all. I don't care, even if they do stare. I haven't got a mind at all.
To be honest, with the recording of that album, I feel quite lucky. I was in the right place at the right time with the right friends. We were all thinking the same way. I think that's by far still my favourite album, because it just has that enthusiasm about it. And we were quite young and quite hungry and just going for it without really thinking, and with that wonderful way that youth has.
People wouldn't leave their kiddies on the M1. Might get run over, splish, splat, dead.
I thought up that silly percussion part where anything we could get our hands on in the room, really, like a buzzer and a bell and whatever, and we sort of arranged it for four people to make it.
I
guess we'd done most of the track. It was early evening, we thought, time to go for a beer, time to knock off and go to the pub. Max and Pat and I duly went off to the pub, and Dave J said, no, I'll just stay here for a bit, I'll see you later. And we went and had a couple of beers, and then toddled back to the studio. And when we got in and looked through the panel of the control room, David was sitting on a stool with a bucket of water and a spoon and this look of absolute manic concentration on his face. And saying to the engineer, no, not this one, no, one more try. And all he was trying to do was get that water sound that you hear on the Splissy Splashy bathroom verse. But he was obsessed and concentrated on getting his splash in the right place with this bucket of water. And we'd had a couple of beers by then, and we came in, what the fuck is going on here? But it all worked, in a way.
I was approached by Daniel, Ash and Kevin, my brother, with the idea of forming a new band whilst I was in the Jazz Butcher. And we'd done the two albums. And I remember once, again, we mentioned Rolo earlier, Rolo being at this gig that I was playing with the Jazz Butcher, and he was aware of this situation. I remember him taking me aside and trying to persuade me to stay with the Jazz Butcher and dissuade me from joining Love and Rockets. And his argument was, you know, you're really coming up with the Jazz Butcher now, and things are going very well. And although you have some, you know, the success with Bauhaus, this is a completely different thing. It's without Peter Murphy, and you've got no assurance that he's going to do anything whatsoever. So I would really think very hard about this. In fact, if I was you, I'd stick with, you know, the devil you know, and stay with the Jazz Butcher. You know, it's a winner, you know. By this time, I'd made my decision, you know, I was going to go with what became Love and Rockets. But it was funny that, thinking back to that time, he was so insistent. But no, it did feel like time to move on. And it'd been great, and we produced the recordings that we produced and had a really wonderful time touring. But I felt itchy, you know. And so that offer came at just the right time, and dived straight into the Love and Rockets thing. And, you know, that story.
Winding it up here. Girlfriend.
We had this rule for the first two or three albums that we got it from The Clash. No love songs. And what I like about Girlfriend is it sounds like a love song. And it's not. It is actually talking about other people's girlfriends. And people think it's some kind of unfaithfulness song because it goes like, you know, my best friend's girlfriend, I got a girlfriend, you're somebody's girlfriend too. And it sounds like the guy's having an affair or something. But it's not. It's purely observational. It was like, basically, I saw people in the street that afternoon and it's like, oh, my best friend's girlfriend. Oh, I've got a girlfriend. Oh, you're somebody's girlfriend. And it's purely observational. And yet it sounds like a big romantic thing, you know. And I love doing that with songs. There's a few of those that I've done that they sound like I've got this huge emotional investment. But to say they're hack jobs is wrong, but also they are actually, like, emotion-free. They just kind of sound romantic. And that's kind of nice. If ordinary shit sounds romantic, then it makes it a bit more worth bothering with, doesn't it?
Max Heider, I think your musicianship really accompanies Pat Fish very well. Do you think you might have a connection with him you may not have with any other musician?
Probably, yeah. I mean, I really enjoy playing on David's stuff as well. But, yeah, I think there is something about the way he writes that does suit the way I play. After I left the band, Pat went on to make some great records. In fact, I think he probably made his best records. The Jazz Butcher's best records are probably after I left. But I think there is something about the way we chime together. One of the reasons we did split up, I mean, we split up because we had an almighty bust-up, basically. But there was a kind of slight parting of the ways in that I was writing more and I was more and more interested in songs as songs. And Pat was, at that point, getting a bit more interested in sound and making a harder noise. And there was some sort of divergence, as it were, musically.
Oh, look, it's easy. You come round my house, you give me information, then you go home.
It was a little bit of an explosion, but do you think most of it was just creative differences?
No, I think it's the other way around. I think most of it was a bloody appalling row. It's such an old story. I mean, we were drinking too much. We were on the road. We were living a crazy lifestyle, not really realising it, but under quite a lot of pressure. We weren't famous or anything, but a certain amount of pressure to deliver and all that stuff. And anyway, for whatever reason, both of us really started to lose the plot. I mean, I just thought he'd gone mad, but I realised afterwards that I'd gone pretty mad as well. So yes, Geneva. I've told that story so many times, I can't actually remember where it happened.
Is there a specific story that you tell about that Geneva incident?
I mean, I was so drunk that I couldn't remember much about it afterwards, but I think there was a certain amount of violence involved. I don't think no one was seriously damaged, but it was just nastiness. And I just got on the next train home, so that was the end of that.
We used to have at least one fairly serious bust up on every tour, partly because we were all drinking so much, I think. But Max left in the middle of a tour in autumn of 86, I guess it was. And as I say, he's my best friend, and I didn't go with him, which might or might not have been the right decision at the time. But I didn't want to walk out in the middle of a tour. I quit at about the end of that year, basically the end of that tour. I already had my girlfriend here in Hamburg, and I came here for a couple of weeks and had a think and decided I'd had enough as well. I couldn't really imagine going on with it without Max, to be honest. I was offered a job in another band, and 6 months after that, I decided to move to Germany anyway. And, you know, I wrote to Pat, and it was all very civil. I told him my reasons, and so we didn't particularly fall out. In fact, we've fallen out less since then than we did when we were both in the band. Then he asked me to do some backing singing and stuff from Condition Blue, and I've been sort of occasionally involved ever since then.
We specifically talked to him about Geneva and sort of an explosion between the two of you. Can you talk to that also?
Oh, yes, certainly can. First of all, it was Zurich, not Geneva.
Oh, you said Geneva.
No, it's Zurich. The number of times I've heard it referred to as the Zurich incident, like something out of a 1970s airport novel, you know. You've got to bear in mind, I mean, we've been talking about them making a scandal, and I'm saying that three out of the four of us hadn't got a clue. Well, imagine how much madder it got when Scandal was a success, and we started touring, you know, initially a few dates in Germany, and then suddenly, like, full-on European tours, like we did two in a year, plus festivals. And we'd barely fallen into it. Initially, we had Dave on board, and that was great. It gave us some kind of perspective and stability, but when he went to do Love and Rockets, we got this fella in who was less experienced with that kind of thing than we were, and he didn't handle it very well, and after a couple of years, we had to let him go. It was in the autumn of 86 when he'd gone, so like we were onto our third live bass player, as it were. We'd been a bit stuck for whom to take with us for this tour. And we alighted upon a chap Max knew better than I, actually. A very decent, very nice kind of a guy, very musical as well. So we thought, well, he's really a guitarist, but we'll take him on to play bass. But I have to say that by the time we'd been through Germany and into Switzerland, he'd started to get on my nerves in a big way. He did a really stupid thing. We used to have a very simple rule on the bus: don't take drugs through borders. Very simple rule. Smoke them on the way to the border. Swallow anything you've got left. Don't be a twat. Don't take drugs through borders. And we arrived in Switzerland, in Zurich, the night before our gig, and the geezer put us in Hotel La Putana. It was like Hotel El Bastardo. It was the kind of place you wouldn't want your enemies to stay. And we sat in there miserable as arseholes. Richard I, for it was he, this bass player, went into his ridiculous 1980s trendy trousers, undid a little stitch, and produced a tiny, tiny lump of hash. And it's like, cheer up, chaps, look what I smuggled through the border. And I'm afraid my first reaction to this was, Richard, you are fucking cunt. I'm afraid my first reaction to this was not positive. No, but it means something different in English, doesn't it? But that's another story. Yeah, I was furious with the cunt. It span out of control, and me and Richard the First had a bit of a fucking set too, and we were all drunk and miserable in this horrid hotel. And the next day we went to do the gig in Zurich, and it was the opening of a nightclub, and it was full of horrible rich people who wanted to listen to disco, and we'd got like a 45-minute set. We're in the middle of a tour, we're hard as nails, we're not very entertaining, we're quite nasty. And there's these clowns who just want to take cocaine and chat to each other about how rich they are while we're trying to do a set. And it just wound us up more and more. There's a cassette of that gig and towards the end of Zombie Love, you can hear me having some kind of mild paddy. And then after I've said my piece, right, you just hear Ida go, right, have some of this, you cunts. And the guitar just goes like, boom. Basically, we are already committing acts of extreme violence upon the audience. Oh, I forgot to tell you about supper. I mean, I know this is a long story, right, but this is what builds up to the Zurich incident. These are all the little sort of mini quakes that lead up to the big one. Supper that night. There's snow on the ground outside. It's Zurich. It's November. It's snowing. Supper. Oh, yeah, vegetarian, yeah. We get a slice of cold mozzarella with a slice of cold tomato on top and a little sprinkle of basil on top. That's our fucking supper, John. That's dinner. And then, you know, we have a few drinks and we play. And this hostile environment is made manifest, so we turn hostile on it. We do our shit and we come off and we get paid. And we're sitting in the dressing room and I'm sitting with my back to the wall with a huge table in front of me. The table is laden with about 36 glasses, 12 tins, couple of bottles. It's just absolutely laden, this table. And we're all sitting in the dressing room and we haven't got it out of our systems. You know, we're still really angry and basically we want to do an encore so we can really fuck them up. But of course they're totally uninterested and the disco music's already gone on. And so we're all just sitting there seething. And I take a go on a joint and I take a go on a beer and life goes on and, like, you know, people are doing the niceties of, like, yeah, good job, man, and all this shit, you know. And we're all pissed off as arseholes. And at some point, I express my exasperation with the entire scenario by going, yeah, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do fucking next year, man. I'm going to go out. I'm going to do a few fucking gigs on my own. At this point, as I say this, Max is just coming to this table, presumably to pick up a beer or something. And, man, talk about taking things in a funny way. Our eyes met and there was just fury, right? And I thought, oh, fuck. I'll proper upset him this time. And the next thing that happens, he upends this huge table full of all his crap, right? He just upends it upon me. And I'm sat there in the ruins going, oh, shit. I didn't even mean it. Honestly, I was thinking about going down the local pub and, like, strumming an acoustic and getting all this crap out of my system. And the next thing I know, I've got half the product of the Western European glass industry in my lap. And he's totally at it. He's like, fuck it, man, I'm doing my solo album anyway, so fuck you with your fucking solo shit, you ungrateful slob. You know, and I'm like, what the fuck? And everyone goes back to the Hotel La Putana and we sit there in the squalor, all fucking going mental and drunk. And that's the Zurich incident. And come the dawn, we all get up and everyone's very solemn and sallow and damaged. And Max goes, yeah, that's it, I'm taking the train home. And I said, yeah, fair enough, I'll come and see you off. We drive with the band to the railway station. And then just him and me get off and go for a drink. And we're sat there and, you know, he's going, look, you know what's, yeah, you know, I'm going home, you can see it, can't you? And I'm going, yeah, I can see it, yeah. And we have a couple of drinks and then he goes and gets on the train. And just as he goes to leave, he says, you know, we know that an era is coming to an end and that, like, somehow we've offended each other in ways that weren't intended, but it's done. And, like, he's just on, you know, the final scene of the movie. And he turns to me and he goes, yeah, at least it didn't turn violent, eh? And I go, yeah, at least it didn't turn violent, eh? And I see him off into the station and I wave him off and he goes back to London. And I get back on the tour bus, and they're all sitting there like death, you know. And I get back on the tour bus, and everyone's like death, so I sit there like death, and we drive off, and we go about 30 miles on the way to the next gig. And suddenly I think, yeah, at least it didn't turn violent.
Then last, we'll bring it home with My Desert.
Not a joke. It is there, and it is waiting. I'll send it all on the sleeve notes, man.
I know, I looked at those notes and I just wanted to, even if you had said what you had said on the notes, I just wanted to hear your voice saying it, so.
Respect. Thank you. Yeah, that makes me feel that we have not been wasting our time.
What about your relationship with Max causes years working together, years apart, and what seems many, many more years working back together now?
I don't know. I mean, the guitars chime. I don't know if it's our sense of timing or the fact that we have a lot of musical influences and beloved records in common or quite what, but we kind of chime. I've been really lucky, actually. I've played with some fantastic guitar players over the years. Mm-hmm. Not just Max, but like Alex Lee, Richard Formby. But there's a little chime there that happens when Ida and I play. It's its own thing. It's not necessarily better than anything else, but it's kind of an identifiable feel, and we wouldn't still be doing it from time to time if it wasn't pleasant for us as well.
I've liked your songwriting after he had left, and I still feel like I liked those songs that he was on. There was something about his playing, his melody to what you were playing, that I thought was always brilliant.
We were very influenced when we started out. We were very influenced by records which then were very old, though in fact they're probably less old. From 1984 to the 50s is probably less time than from now to Scandal in Bohemia. But they seemed like almost prehistoric artifacts at the time. We just loved the simplicity, old doo-wop records, old soul records, 50s rock and roll, even jump jive records from the late 40s. We just loved that old shit. Max especially, he somehow got a take on that kind of almost like Memphis soulful but also very melodic sound. And then, of course, he developed it. You know, I think he had to get out of the Jazz Butcher to develop the sound that he has today and the stylings he has today. I just wouldn't have been able to keep up with the chord theory at the time. I mean, I can do it now. I know what he's talking about now, but I'm 55 as well. To go the way that he was going and to become the guitar player that he has become, he probably had to get out of what was essentially a three-chord punk group, you know? And likewise, I was going like, oh, stop playing jazz on my three-chord punk.
You started a solo career, which continues to this day, and returned back to Jazz Butcher about 9 years later in 1995-ish.
Our bust up didn't really last very long. I mean, we started talking to each other quite soon after that. And he was very nice about my solo album when it came out. And so, you know, there was no sort of ongoing bitterness like that. It just felt like, to be honest, it seemed to me that we'd both done the right thing, you know. Because I went on, you know, I mean, my solo career was a bit of a damp squib in commercial terms. My, you know, the record company went bust and everything. But at least I'd made the album. I carried on. It started me off on a songwriting career, is not quite the right word, but I started to take myself a bit more seriously as a songwriter, and that's been the thing that I've really got the most satisfaction out of over the years. So I don't regret any of that. By the time we got back together, it all felt great again, and we made a couple albums since, and particularly the one we've just made, we're both very happy with, so it's really nice to have got back to it, to be honest. And you know, back in the studio when we were recording this summer, it all those things that I was talking to you about, you know, the way his songwriting and my guitar playing seems, you know, he seems to give me a freedom. Some people sometimes say to me, why is your guitar playing so much more sort of, I don't know, elaborate and why is there so much more guitar playing on the Jazz Butcher records than on your solo albums? And it's partly because, you know, I'm not making solo albums as a guitarist, I'm making them as a songwriter. But I think it's also partly, that, as you were suggesting, that there's something about Pat's songs that just really sort of fire up my instrumental juices, as it were.
We're all still at it in some form or other. You've got to, really. I can't imagine stopping.
David J., what is the Jazz Butcher?
I'm Jazz Butcher. It's an extended happy hour on an alternative planet, one which is the result of a big bang occurred in the inimitable mind of one catfish, and still out there spinning, and I think it still has the potential to produce progeny, and long may it remain fertile and drunk.
What is your point of view? Are you a hedonist? A relativist? A materialist? Are you devoted to Camus? To Marx? Or to Einstein? What makes the most sense to you? Physics? Yoga? LSD? LSD?
My desert.
Yes, it's waiting. It is waiting. And there it is.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement Episode 10, featuring the Jazz Butcher's Scandal in Bohemia. All of the musicians interviewed are still at large, creating extremely noteworthy material. David Jay's album, Etiquette of Violence, is scheduled to be re-released with many additional rare tracks on Cherry Red Records on November 25th. Owen Jones and his band Shakespeare and the Bible has released a new album called International Departures. And of course, at jazzbutcher.com, you can find information on their new record, Last of the Gentlemen Adventurers, along with information about their many records, plus a link to Max Eider's site, which has information about his activity, including his last release, Disaffection. Next up, our 11th episode will feature The Queers Don't Back Down, including interviews with B-Face, Wimpy Rutherford, J.J. Razzler, Lisa Marr, and of course, Joe Queer himself. Thank you, and farewell. For now.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement. Make sure to check out the other shows on the TNH Network right here at TuesdayNightHoot.com.